I'm Vermont Edition co-host Bob Kinzel. Just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. I promise this is not an April Fool's Day show, but it might feel like it to some people who thought they'd be getting a big tax break after changes to the federal tax code for 2018. We've been hearing people express, well, surprise would be a charitable way of putting it, that they actually owed money when they did their taxes this year or didn't get back what they were hoping for. For many of us, doing our taxes is always a little bit of a mystical process. But there are lots of things about the tax code and our professional relationships to it that we could understand a little bit better. And then some things that are difficult to figure out unless you are an accountant or a financial planner and can spend your days poring over all the details. So those are the kinds of people we've invited on the show today to talk to us about what they know about how all of this is working at the state and federal level and to answer your tax questions and concerns. Joining me in the studio is Liz Scharf. She's a financial counselor with Capstone Community Action, which serves low and moderate income people in central Vermont, and Steve Trenholm, tax director at Gallagher Flynn and Company, a tax, accounting, and business firm in South Burlington. What a pleasure to have you both here during the busy season. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you, Jane.
Thanks.
Have you both done your taxes already?
No.
Yes.
No, Steve, you haven't. I would imagine it's like a prerequisite of the job is you have to get them done in, you know, by February 1st or something.
No, actually, I always wait till the last minute, unfortunately. Clients first.
Is that just because you're a procrastinator or is there a benefit to waiting until April?
Well, it puts off the agony.
And Liz, you're not a procrastinator. Well done.
Yeah, no, I did them and I was, I think, pleasantly surprised, I guess.
Because you got a bigger refund than you thought. And not to delve too deeply into your personal finances, but.
Yeah, well, the good news for me was that I still got to take, well, I got to take the child tax credit that I wasn't able to take last year. And I have a child in college, so I got to take the American Opportunities tax credit. So it is beneficial when you have kids. With those credits.
All right. So we're going to talk about all of that because that's one of the things that's changed. And I think especially on the minds of people are the changes to standard versus itemized deductions. So we'll talk about that. But let me just ask you first, you know, the tax code is confusing. Nobody debates that. It's just confusing. And even if you read up on it 1 year so you feel like, I got it, I totally understand how I fit into this picture, then it changes. And there's the state tax code and the federal tax code. And God forbid you worked in two different states or moved here from another country. And, you know, for many of us, especially people who just have a W-2, why bother learning about it? You can go online. If you make under a certain amount, you can do your taxes for free online. You could also hire a tax preparer, but they can walk you through the process. You get your documents, you just do what they tell you. And at the end, there's a number and you either get money back or you pay some money. Steve, what is the value of even trying to understand even a tiny little bit of the tax code?
Well, Jane, if you're just a W-2 employee, maybe a small family, probably not. I mean, even for us tax professionals, unfortunately, there were still changes coming through in January of 2019 that were affecting 2018. So this year it's gotten very, very complicated. Computer software that's out there is great. But there are those people that really like to have a good handle on understanding everything. So if you're that type of person, then you probably want to maybe get it done by a professional and have them walk you through it. And then you can go back and cross-check and read up on the regulations.
Is it a good idea to maybe hire a professional for 1 year, see how they do it, and then do it on your own the next year? A good budget-conscious way of doing it?
Well, that's a good budget-conscious way of doing it. But unfortunately, there could be major changes from 2018 to 2019, depending on legislation. So you may not get anywhere.
So, Liz Scharf, what about for you? I mean, from your perspective, is there any value in trying to understand these things? I mean, certainly for some people, if you're an independent contractor, if you own your own business, you might need to know some things because you could certainly get penalized at the end of the year if you, for example, haven't taken out the right amount of taxes to sort of, you know, prepay your taxes if you're an independent contractor. But it's just so complicated and it keeps changing. It just feels like, yeah, why bother?
So I think it's important. I think a lot of people don't understand when they're receiving a refund what that refund actually means. And for a lot of people who are in the lower income bracket, getting a tax refund isn't really what they paid in, because they may actually have a zero taxable income, but what they're getting are credits. So whether that's the earned income tax credit, which is a major program that lifts people out of poverty, or the child tax credit, those are credits that you need to be aware of, one, when they expire and how they expire. So as the more money you make, you may see less of a tax refund, or as your child's as your children age out of the child tax credit, you may find that you're not getting what you thought you would get back. So I think just being informed about what those credits actually are and what you're getting is really important for anyone.
Just very briefly, and I think a lot of people know this, but just so that we all have it in our heads, the difference between a tax credit and a tax deduction.
Sure. So a tax deduction reduces the amount of your taxable income, whereas a credit actually reduces your tax liability. And some credits are refundable and some credits are non-refundable. So for example, the earned income tax credit is a refundable credit. So even if you don't owe any money, you'll still get a credit. Part of the child tax credit is refundable up to $1,400. But I do see folks in the very low income, so those that are making, say, the federal minimum wage, for example, are not getting that full $1,400 tax credit. So, you know, the advertisements out there make it sound really great, but there are people who don't actually get a child tax credit at all if they really make very little, or if they're making just minimum wage, they may not get the full credit.
So the way I've often thought about it is a credit is you get money. That's money that goes to you. A deduction would lower if you had to pay in, but you can't get a deduction that is, you know, gives you more money than zero. Is that a, you know, sort of like a simplistic way to think
of it? So deductions are actually amounts. So you have something called an adjusted gross income. And so the standard deduction, so let's say you made, so the average Vermont income for a family of four, let's say, is around $58,000. So you get to deduct. So if you're married filing jointly, this year you'll get to deduct $24,000. So your taxable income is $58,000 minus $24,000. So that's considered a deduction. And then there's also a few other deductions that can come into play. Itemized deductions, for example, you used to be able to take if it was more than the $12,700 plus yeah, more than that for married filing jointly. Now most people can't do it. And they got rid of the exemptions as well. So, for example, a family of four that used to be able to deduct if it was just the standard deduction, they may have been able to deduct $28,900. Now they can only do $24,000. So their taxable income is now higher. So it really, you know, but they may have children to counter those credits.
Or their tax bracket. They may have
lowered. Yes, and their tax bracket lowered. So overall, they're paying less on their taxable income because that changed for everyone. The taxes went down for the tax brackets. However, their taxable income may be higher because they're no longer able to itemize.
And let's go to Bob, who's calling in from Rutland City. Hi, Bob.
Yes, thank you. I was going to say, I just wanted to ask your guest, too, and comment that I know the council, the national committee, I should say, to preserve Social Security and Medicare pointed out that I think back in February, on the 14th of February, that the income has been capped. In other words, for incomes of $132,000 or more, they no longer have to pay Social Security taxes? As I understand it, of course, all their workers have to pay, like, what, 6.2%?
Bob, thanks for the question. Steve Trenholm, Social Security taxes.
Well, that's partially correct, Bob. That cap is for the Social Security piece of the withholding. The Medicare piece of the withholding, which is 1.45%, is actually unlimited. So at $132,000, you stop paying the 6% piece of it, and the remaining 1.45% is unlimited, unfortunately, depending on if you had $1 million worth of taxable wages, it would be taxed at 1.45 for Medicare.
Bob is – oh, I think Bob left. I was going to ask if that was affecting him and how that might then you know, play into how you think about your taxes.
Well, you really don't have any control over that because as a W-2 employee, it's automatically withheld. The only thing you can do is if you have the opportunity to delay or accelerate bonuses with your employer, that would be a way of mitigating some of the Social Security tax.
So, Steve, Liz was talking a moment ago about changes to the standard deduction. And, you know, again, it's different for different people. But basically, the standard deduction was doubled. So if you're a married couple filing jointly, you used to be able to have a standard deduction of $12,700. And so, you know, unless you had an expensive house and lots of other things that you were doing and maybe giving a lot to charitable organizations, you might take the standard deduction and come out better than what, you know, you would have done if you were trying to itemize. That's been doubled now. So it's a much higher bar for that standard deduction. So is everybody raking in the dough now?
Well, not really, because one of the other major changes that took place was the cap on state, local, and you know, municipal real estate and state income taxes. Those are now capped at $10,000. So let's say you paid $100,000 in real estate taxes and state income taxes. That's now capped at $10,000. So,
as in the deduction is
the capped deduction is capped. So someone that used to have, say, $130,000 worth of itemized deductions because of that may now be taking the standard deduction of $24,000. So that's a very big change that we're seeing with a lot of our taxpayers, because they do tend to be higher net worth and have higher property taxes.
Liz Schar, for people who maybe, you know, didn't actually, I mean, who made out well with that standard deduction, having that standard deduction doubled, is that good for people who are lower or moderate income?
Yeah, it is. But I think that for the most part, because in the past, last year in 2017, for example, for a family of four, you got to take exemptions on everyone. And so
everyone else in your household, you mean?
Yeah, everyone else in your household. And so often that $24,000 is probably fairly similar, if not less, than what you were able to take the previous year.
Because that wasn't included in the standard deduction previously. So
right.
That $12,700 didn't include personal exemptions,
right,
on yourself and your dependents.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so who's sort of making out is the people with kids. So if you made enough money to get the full child tax credit, say you have two kids, that might be an extra $4,000 in your pocket. I did a little bit of math to kind of see, like, what was it looking like in terms of, like, low-income folks? So, like, say those doing those who are earning minimum wage versus, say, the median income of $58,000. And the reality is that low-income people, so someone on minimum wage, for example, doesn't have a tax liability. So they actually, once they have their standard deduction, they often have $0 that is their taxable income. So they owe nothing to the government. But what they do get are credits, like I said, the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit. So with the changes that came into play for 2018, it's about like a 1.5% increase or 2% increase for someone earning minimum wage of what they see in their spendable income for the year with the credits included. And that's not a very big gain. It's actually a little bit less than inflation when I did the math, whereas the average family of making around $58,000 sees about a 4% gain overall after, you know, all of their taxes come out and their credits are given to them. So it's not a win for the very low income people. The tax reform really didn't do much to help them out at all.
And Steve, what are you seeing in terms of people who are at the upper income brackets? Are they, you know, again, knowing everybody's situation is different, generally speaking, are they seeing a benefit this year?
They're seeing a slight benefit because of the increase in the brackets, decrease in the rates. There are also many of those people, because they had high taxes, which are a tax preference item, were being pushed into the alternative minimum tax in prior years. Because the cap is now $10,000, that's kind of gone away. So most of our taxpayers are seeing a slight benefit or maybe paying more. Depends. That's from a federal standpoint. And if you want to factor in the states as well, that's a little bit different because, as you know, Vermont changed to adjusted gross income in 2018 for taxes that you file in 2019. So that's been a change that a lot of people have seen. one of the biggest populations that was affected by that is the very charitable people from a Vermont standpoint, because Vermont eliminated the deduction for charitable contributions, and instead they're giving a 5% credit, but the maximum credit is $1,000. So if you made a $20,000 contribution, you get the maximum credit. If you made a $200,000 contribution, you still get the maximum $1,000 credit. So again, at a 8.75% top rate, it's not as big of a deal as it is federally, but it has caused some concern amongst a lot of very charitable people.
I can't imagine being in a position to make a $200,000 charitable donation.
You'd be surprised, Jane, how many people out there that do that and do that regularly.
I'm glad they're out there. I mean, it is a remarkable way that many organizations, and certainly work for a nonprofit, I understand this, stay viable and sustainable. But boy, that's – I mean, we're talking about people – first, we're talking about people who make so little that they owe nothing on their taxes. And then we're talking about people who are, you know, trying to figure out these just enormous sums of money. And it points out how different the situation is for so many different kinds of people. And yet we have this tax code that's supposed to accommodate all of us. And again, this is also remedial, but I often have to remind myself of this, that when, let's say, you make $500,000 a year, the initial part of your earnings, you're not taxed on that $500,000 all equally, right, Steve? So
that's
just
right.
Remind us, the tax brackets apply to everybody. It's just you keep going up on the extra money you earn over and above each tax bracket the higher you go.
That's correct. We have a system called the graduated tax rates, and the highest tax rate for individuals is 37%. So someone who has taxable income in excess of – and that's taxable income – in excess of somewhere around $600,000 would be in the 37% tax bracket. The lowest tax bracket obviously is zero, upwards between 15, 22, 25, and then, you know, you hit the 30s and 37%. So
today we're talking taxes with two people who spend even more time thinking about taxes than you do. Steve Trenholm is tax director at the South Burlington firm Gallagher Flynn & Company, and Liz Scharf is a financial counselor with Capstone Community Action, which helps low and moderate income families and individuals in several Vermont counties figure out their finances. I asked at the very beginning of the show, is there any benefit to knowing the tax code, understanding it deeply? Amy writes in with a variation on that and says, I've done my own taxes my entire adult life. Understanding the basics of taxes allowed me to make an informed choice between two mortgage options, and the bank was not allowed to give me advice. I would have missed out on hundreds of dollars a year had I made the wrong choice. So yes, it can be very worthwhile being able to do your own taxes. And so Amy's offering a point there about, you know, yeah, maybe it is good for us to know about it. And certainly when you're trying to figure out how to figure out with a new employer what you want taken out every month, an understanding, a basic understanding of how taxes work can make a big difference and certainly prevent some pain in April. Let's go to E, who's calling in from Rutland City representing today. E, go right ahead.
Hi, thanks for getting my call. I've called before and you've been very generous every time. I just wanted to ask the difference between the state and the federal and Social Security. How much is it that do they tax it? Do I have to pay on what I already paid? Is it something different to every state? And is there an amount at which I start paying separately from any other income I might have? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks for the call. So, Steve, again, we're talking about Social Security taxes at the state level.
Sure. Well, at the state level, every state is different on how they tax Social Security. Many states don't tax Social Security. The state of Vermont does tax Social Security if you're over approximately $45,000 to $50,000 in state taxable income.
How can it be that somebody might get back a refund, a federal refund of, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 and then owe on the state taxes? I mean, if you, as I said, if you're doing, you know, you go to your HR department when you take your new job or at the beginning of the year and you say, this is how much I want you taking out based on, you know, my family situation. And then how can it be so different from state to federal? Liz?
Well, I'm laughing because that's always happened to me, that I would get a refund and then I'd owe the state. Some of it has to do with sort of your income. So if you're especially a two-income family, this always happened to me when I didn't make a lot of money. So they didn't tax me enough. But then my husband made more money. And so as a combined family, our income was enough to get us where we owed a certain amount of money to the state, and we didn't have enough taken out. So that's really important for folks, especially in Vermont, where people are doing multiple jobs, is to know that if you are especially in working several jobs, that they may not be taking out enough taxes between your jobs. But once you add them all up together, you may be in for a surprise and see that you actually owe taxes. Another thing that is often a
problem. Can I stop you there? Because so this used to happen in my family situation, where my husband was an independent contractor. And so they didn't, he had to take out his own taxes and prepay, because it's not only that you may owe a lot at the end, but if you know that, you could calculate, you can actually face a penalty if you're not paying your taxes, or if you haven't paid enough of them. And then come, your filing deadline in April, they say, well, hang on, you owed us money all year round. Not only do you still owe us this money, but you actually owe us a penalty. So you should be knowing, if you're an independent contractor or a freelancer, how much tax you're going to owe.
Yeah, and I remember actually having to pay the penalty. Steve, how much is it if it's over like $1,000 or something that you owe? They're going to make you pay a penalty. And the other thing is that a lot of people in Vermont get what are called 1099 miscellaneouses. So for these sort of small jobs, like I'm going to go and do a landscaping job for someone and I'm going to get a 1099 miscellaneous, no taxes are taken out for that. And that includes the self-employment tax. So regardless, you're going to have to pay the 15%, which is your portion of the Social Security and Medicare, as well as the quote unquote employer's portion. But since you're self-employed, you have to pay both of those. And that can come as a surprise to people when they realize that, oh, I actually owe money because of this 1099 miscellaneous.
Well, in addition to that, Liz, a lot of people are getting 1099s now from Amazon and eBay for the things that they're selling online, which never used to take place. So that becomes part of your taxable income. So you get that in January of 2019, and all of a sudden you found out that you've got $5,000 worth of sales on Amazon. It's an unpleasant surprise.
There was a big push a couple years ago within Vermont that there may have been employers miscategorizing employees as independent contractors when they should have been employees. And that was a big part of it, right? That if you're categorized as an independent contractor, but actually you're working 40 hours a week, you're not setting your hours or what jobs you're doing, and you should be an employee, you're kind of having to pay double the taxes, and the employer is getting away with not having to pay that portion of the taxes. Is that still an issue that we see?
Once in a while, the Department of Labor has been very good about making sure that employers categorize properly employees in the state of Vermont. Just to go back to what you said about doubling the tax, it's the Social Security and Medicare tax, because as an independent contractor, you're subject to the same income tax rates, but you're
right,
subject
yes.
to self-employment tax, which basically is both sides of the Social Security and Medicare. So
let's go to Elizabeth, who's calling in from Orwell. Hi, Elizabeth. You have a question?
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call. My mom passed last year, and I inherited an IRA that I cashed in because I needed the funds. And the minimum amount was taken out at the time. And I am not sure, A, if the whole thing would be taxable, and then I have a really kind of a startup just DBA. I don't know. I know there's no deductions for personal stuff. Could my DBA potentially have, I had some small investment in some projects that are part of that. That's question one. And the second one is, I personally don't have my own IRA. If I contributed the maximum amount for the IRA, if I set one up, would that be deductible?
Elizabeth, thanks for the questions. A lot of them there. Who wants to tackle these? Who feels equipped? Steve?
Sure. Well, Elizabeth, unfortunately, by taking that IRA all in one shot, that does make it taxable. Even though it's inherited, anything that is tax deferred, which an IRA would be, that's inherited, becomes taxable when you, as the person that inherited it, draws it out. But the other two things that you pointed out. Number one, if you have a small DBA, you should keep track of what possible business expenses that you have. You say you had some projects that you invested in. You may have bought a computer, some office furniture, those types of things, mileage. Those would definitely help to offset any taxable income from the IRA. And yes, you could potentially go and put some money in an IRA. What I would suggest is that you do your taxes without it first, because you have until the date of filing your taxes or April 15th, whichever is the later. And C, because if you put the maximum in the IRA, you're not going to get a dollar-for-dollar benefit for it. It's going to be based on whatever your tax bracket is. So if you put $5,000 in an IRA and you only get, say, $1,500 worth of tax benefit, it may not be worth it for you.
All right. Elizabeth, I hope that helps. Let's go to John in Burlington. John, go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Got a question. So I have a relative who is in his mid-20s, lives at home, and makes no income, supported by his parents. Is he still responsible for filing? Thanks. That's my question.
Thanks, John. Liz?
No, not if he didn't have any income. He may. So that's another thing in terms of if you have kids living at home. If kids are working and have like part-time jobs, for example, they can still file their taxes and get back what they paid out in federal and state taxes. But their parents probably are still claiming them as part of, you know, maybe getting a credit for them. Like a dependent care credit is now a new credit where you can get up to $500, a non-refundable credit. But no, if you didn't make any income, you don't need to file taxes. Most people, so even if you have Social Security, the only reason, like, and you're an old person with very limited incomes and Social Security, the only reason that you'd probably want to file is if you had property or you wanted your renter's rebate. So you would do your property tax rebate request as well as a renter's rebate request.
So in the case of this 22-year-old, how long can his parents claim him as a dependent?
Well, as a dependent child, potentially up to age 24, but he could be claimed for multiple years after that if he meets the dependency test outside of being a dependent child.
And what's the dependency test?
The dependency test is basically if you provide more than 50% of that person's support, then, you know, they are a dependent of yours.
So it's not just age-based. It's if, you know, if they are living at home and eating your food and you're paying for their car and you're paying for their cell phone and, you know, you make sure that they stay alive, then they can still be counted.
And that's something that's very important, too, with elderly parents that are living with you as well to take a look at.
Good point. Jason's calling in from Shelburne. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jane, and hi, Liz and Steve. Steve, I just wanted to follow up on something that Steve spoke about a while ago related to Vermont. As he noted, Vermont moved from a federal taxable income base, a number after deducting medical taxes and charity, to an adjusted gross income base before itemized deductions. And he noted that you, by doing so, you couldn't deduct charitable contributions. The other significant thing that is impacting a number of my clients is the lack of a medical deduction. So I've got clients who are having significant expenses for elder care or residential care for medical and having to generate significant income in order to pay those expenses. And because Vermont no longer allows for that deduction, they're paying significantly more in Vermont taxes than they're paying federal taxes. And I'm just curious as to whether Steve is seeing that as well.
Yeah, Jason, thanks for the call.
Yeah, Jason, thank you. Yes, we are seeing that both in the practice and I sit on the Tax Structure Commission at the state of Vermont as well. And we've gotten some inquiries based on that as to what can be done to help those people. So, yes, that is unfortunate for the elder population.
You know, Liz, I think we may have talked about this before, but using your taxes as basically a savings account or a way to get a big chunk of money at the end. I know it goes against financial advice because you're essentially giving the government an interest-free loan for the year that's your money that you could be either saving or doing something else with. But for many people, it actually is kind of the way that they save for the year. Is it better than nothing to, like, you know, work your taxes so that you know you're going to get a big refund and you're not spending that money than it would be if you were at least spending that money all year long?
Sure. Yeah. I think that a lot of it is just a mindset of knowing that you're going to get a refund in February. I mean, if you think about what you're earning in a savings account, less than 1%, and that you have access to it, knowing that, yeah, you may be loaning the government the money, but the fact is that this is the opportunity where many people have a large influx of cash that they really count on to pay back old bills or prepay bills.
Or pay for a new boiler or whatever
right,
you've been saving for.
You know, go out to dinner because they don't get to do that. So so tax time, yeah, is it mathematically the smartest thing to do? Probably not. But it really does make a difference for a lot of people come tax time.
So that guilt, you don't have the guilt.
Okay. No, I do the same thing, Jane.
And, you know, another thing that I remember back at the end of 2017 when we were hearing so much about these tax changes and the big tax cut. And of course, that was a whole political conversation and we don't have time to get into that. But one of the things that was talked about was that a lot of these tax cuts are temporary and certainly much can change between now and 2025. But should we all be thinking now about what might happen in a couple of years with the tax code, given that tax codes change all the time and these tax breaks that may have impacted our filing right now are set to expire?
Well, we've had numerous conversations with clients, both business and individual, about that. And we always suggest that if it's going to be a temporary benefit, but there's a long-term or a short-term large cost, it's not worth doing. You just have to be cognizant of what the outcome is going to be. And again, you know, 2025, it may not be 2025. It could be 2020, depending on what happens in the political climate that things change. So we like to say, don't let the tax tail wag the dog.
Easier said than done. That's Steve Trenholm, tax director at Gallagher Flynn & Company, a financial accounting and tax firm in South Burlington. Steve, thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you, Jane.
And Liz Scharf, a financial counselor with Capstone Community Action. Liz, thanks for you being on the program today as well.
Thanks a lot, Jane.
I'll also point out that the state's chief healthcare advocate, Michael Fisher, wrote in wanting us to talk about premium tax credits, which help lower Vermont Health Connect premiums for certain people depending on their income. And we didn't have a chance to talk about that, but we will put the link that he sent us up at vpr.org.